Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to KGNU Public Affair. I am your host, Tish Buford, and we have in studio with us this morning two extraordinarily special guests, and this is very much an honor and a privilege for me because these women have given birth to me and helped raise me. And in light of what's going on in our state capital and what our country is not only celebrating and overcoming, we want to talk about the ascension of women in politics, women of color, and in particular, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, who was soon to be voted in as the first woman and woman of color, specifically African-American and South Asian-American woman to the Vice Presidency of the United States of America. And the two guests that we're going to be discussing this with are two pioneering Black women who have resided in red states, of all things, throughout this country's tumultuous relationship with voting and integration and equal rights. So please provide a very, very warm welcome to my mother, Deborah Flakes Jenkins, and my aunt, Miss Deborah Bunting. Good morning, ladies. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I know you guys are very entrenched in politics, culture, and community. That's been a big part of your identity for the last, what since you guys were born. but when did politics and civil rights and community activism become a part of who you were? I mean, before you became mothers and wives and so forth, when did it really strike you that it was really important? I'll let you go ahead first, Ms. Beverly. When did it become very clear to you that activism and community involvement was going to matter to you?
During the time that I was part of the Lyndon B. Johnson's Youth Council, I served on that and part of the Mayor Sorensen's Youth Board in high school. And okay. it was part of the fact that we were looking at, we had a lot of racial unrest going on in Omaha at the time. And, you know, there was just, we were trying to get just simple things done as teenagers. So mine started as a teenager with working with the Lyndon B. Johnson program.
And what year was this? Was it 1965?
68, yeah. That's when I received my Lyndon B. Johnson Award for my youth activity. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that was 3 years after the voting rights bill was passed.
Yeah, you have to understand that during the time that the civil rights bill was passed, we were still a little bit young. I think we were like 15 when that happened. So we were just growing into what that meant for us. We were starting to, you know, we were getting older and we were starting to grow into that. And when we were taking our civics classes, we started to address some of those things in a program called BUS, which was a Black urban project that was run by one of the ladies at my church at the time to help us be aware of how we needed to interact in the community as young Black students.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. And Ms. Debbie, how did you incorporate yourself into this movement?
I remember attending a Black Panther meeting as a teenager and just being struck by, first I was told not to go because in that era, your parents were afraid. But you know, I was a teenager and knew everything in the world, so I went. And it was like, I found the people that thought the way that I did. I realized there was so much bad going on in the world. In high school, we were being continually challenged. There was civil, I don't call them riots, but there was just civil insurgents all over, and it just was not good. I became very, very active in politics in high school. We started a Black We started a group called Black students here at Central High. We attended a school that was not the traditionally Black high school, which brought its own set of problems. And when the school decided that we were going to be required to read Emperor Jones and Huck Finn aloud, we weren't having it. So we started a Black student union, and we started doing some things that helped other students that weren't active in that in the movement at that time at our high school, because there were problems even with racism involving our basketball team. We had one of the most racist principals in the city at that time. And there was just a lot going on. And at that time, I decided to just get involved, and I went full in, never looked back.
Right. And now we're talking, what, almost 55 years later?
50 plus years
later. And you've evolved and being involved in the Arts Council, you know, as a community development manager, and you've done so many things for outreach, promoting the arts, which I know is a huge star worth for you, and it's very much a soul project for you, something that's been your soul motivation as a retiree. But even before you retired, you know, you always incorporated art into community activism. And how did that play out for you? Throughout the last 50 years, as your involvement and evolution in philanthropy and activism evolved?
It was always at the core of it, because you know, statistically, our children fall behind when we start looking at humanities-based education systems. I realized that the arts were a lot of things that save people. You know, if you look at the pandemic, what's taken us through this? It's been the arts. It's been those versus battles. It's been the memes. It's been all of the words and everything that's made us think at a higher level. But I also understood the power of the arts, and I understood the economic impact of the arts. And I also knew that that is how a lot of communities, particularly communities of color, are able to build and rebuild their systems. For example, what we were able to do in North Omaha by bringing businesses in and developing a strategic plan, we called it the Village Strategy, that an art, culture, and entertainment were at the core of that, because we were able to look back and track how many living wage jobs we could get, artists and creatives are part of our community, and to always be able to share that with them. And I'll keep it brief, but I always looked at my life as being a privileged situation, because I was able to sit in those tables. I was at those tables. I have worked with the Smithsonian, been invited to projects with the National Endowment for the Arts, even a project with Kennedy Center that involved accessibility. Persons with disabilities having accessibility to the arts. But anytime I sat at a table, I bought the culture with me.
That's phenomenal. That's wonderful. And to you, Ms. Benford, you were born in Arkansas, and of course, you know, grew up in Omaha, and you attended a predominantly white elite Jewish college preparatory Jewish high school. And then you went on to get a scholarship, but you chose motherhood instead and got your education later in life. But throughout all these last 50 years in between, you also became one of the few women and women of color to break the color barrier in the phone system, in the phone industry, starting in California and all the way to Denver, Colorado, over a 30-year period. So give us some insight on how you went from being a debutante to activist to mother, like Miss Debbie. You guys were both mothers, you both were wives, and now you are in your retiree stage of your life, teaching children in Monroe, Louisiana, which again is another red state, just like Nebraska. So give us some history behind your life as an activist starting at 18, being in a predominantly white high school, and how that translated into your life as a mother, full-time single working single mother, and then to where you are now in your life.
Well, my journey, to piggyback a little bit off of your Aunt Debbie, we both went to the same high school.
Yes.
And at the time, they had a program in Omaha called Choice. And Choice basically allowed us to go to a school that was not necessarily within our zone. So like we lived in North Omaha, which was predominantly Black.
Right.
But we were allowed to take the bus or walk or however we got there. But we were allowed to go to any school of our choice. Our choice was Central High School at the time. So we went there and we were able to enjoy an education that was different than what we had got when we were in junior high. Our junior high experience had been predominantly Black. So right. we had a transition time. Now for me, it was a little difficult because I had to come into my high school experience and do a learning curve to catch up with where a lot of my white and Jewish peers already were, because our education level was not always at the same level up to that point. Don't get me wrong, we had really good teachers and administrators and principals up along the way, but there were some standard people that we had along the way too, that we didn't always get what we should out of our education. But now to piggyback again off of that, I'd like to say this: when I got to Central, I took a lot of classes and I learned a lot. And like we did have the Black Panther movement going on at the time at the school. Now, I did observe it. I did listen. I knew friends that were in the Black Panthers. And I, like Deb, I really wanted to know what that was about. And I felt the need. We were part of an organization at the school to keep us involved in the activities that we needed to restructure the school, as far as them allowing our integration of the school as Black students to be respected. That was the big thing, key to get respect. Because at the time, like we had a principal that had vowed that he was not going to have people of color or Black kids in his school at one time. So we gotcha. had to overcome that. And okay. We did.
Right. And you guys clearly did. And Ms. Debbie, just to give you a quick response to that before you go into a quick break, do you feel that attending an out of, you know, neighborhood school, which was a predominantly white and Jewish college preparatory school, helped launch your career post high school? Did it help give you an advantage?
It gave me an advantage in that I saw how the game was played.
Okay.
And I saw the inequities, and it gave me an advantage because I knew who and what I was dealing with. And I knew it gave me an idea of what I was going to face in the workplace, but it also gave me a fighter's that warrior spirit.
Absolutely.
Because I wasn't having it. I wasn't having it.
And you're still not having it. You both are extraordinary cultural warriors, and you guys were breaking boundaries even then, being two Black students in a white and Jewish school of elite children that were from money. And you had to break those barriers collectively and individually as Black women, but also presenting united front for the culture and for the rights. And so now that you guys have taken that and moved forward, as I was alluding to with you, Ms. Berber, you had an illustrious career in what's called our incumbent Bell system. And you got all the way to executive management before you were first forced into early retirement. But you were one of the few females and even fewer people of color, specifically Black people, that obtained those positions. How was that like for you, real quickly?
Well, I'm gonna be honest with you. It was not easy. I started off as a cord board operator. And when I was hired, I was told that I was a part of a number. My initial interview for my job in 1972, I was told that I had to pass 3 tests in order to get hired. When I came out, they told me I passed 2, but not the 3rd test. So I picked my purse up and got ready to leave. And she said, where are you going? And I said, I'm leaving. She said, well, you didn't pass the 3rd test. She said, but I think that you can do the job. I later found out that AT&T at the time was going to be denied their rate increase if they didn't hire a certain amount of minorities. And I happened to be one of the minorities that they hired so that they could get their rate increase. And I knew that I was a number. And I knew that I was a factor. But I also was given a 30-day window to show myself. And I had to pass all of my classes within 30 days to be an operator. I still have my operator certificate right now for that 30-day window. But from there, I have had EEO cases that I have filed. I have had, I had to file a lawsuit to keep my job at one point. I fought my way all the way for that, for the 29 and a half years that I worked for the phone company. I did not have anything handed to me. But my biggest challenge, and I'll be honest with you, was sitting in those boardrooms, watching people, mostly people that didn't think I should be there.
Right.
And they would kind of shun me. And when I say shun, that means that shoulder that's kind of at an angle that says, we know you have to be here, but we're not necessarily listening. But I made them listen because I was able to bring the money to the table. I was able to make the sale. I was a sales manager. Right. I was one of the best sales managers they had. So when you are a person of color, you have to work harder and show your ability at a level that is much different than our counterparts.
Absolutely, and that's still the case today in 2020. And we can get into that and a little more on the other side here, but I'm gonna take a quick break for station identification. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Public Affair. I'm your host, Tish Buford. In studio, we have this morning the extraordinary Miss Barbara Flake Jenkins and Miss Deborah Bunting. Now, I want to fast forward a bit. We talked about your high school careers and your challenges in the workplace, your civil rights involvement, what motivated you and triggered you to get involved as teenagers in 1968. Now, being mothers, being wives, and raising Black children, being grandmothers, great-grandmothers, to see where you came from to where we are in 2020, with still a lot of work to be done, no doubt. But how does it feel for you as first generation removed from Jim Crow of being able to legally vote in your own family, to us seeing the first Black female vice president being elected to the White House in less than 60 days? Either one of you guys can answer that. We'll start with you, Ms. Barbara. Go ahead.
It's absolutely wonderful. I am so thrilled that I've been allowed to live long enough to see this day.
Absolutely.
We are transitioning towards our 70th year on this earth, and we've seen a lot. But
yes.
And the thing is, I'm very proud of Kamala, and you know, I've read her bio and I look at her and I can actually relate to some of the things that she's been through. And I know some of the things that she's facing, a whole lot of things, challenges that that are going forward, that is going to be very interesting for a country to see how she manages that. But I know that she's a strong Black woman and she's going to manage that. Because when I look at her, it reminds me of my great-grandmother who helped raise me. And this woman had fortitude. She was born in 1880 and she was 16 when she passed away. I was 16 when she passed away. And when I look at Kamala, I see my great-grandmother in that spirit of being able to be transitional in her way of handling things, and all, but also constantly keeping us balanced with who we are. My great grandmother always made sure I knew who I was, and she reminded me of that all the time. And that was part of the way that I was able to bring all four of my children up with respect. And that's the main key right now. I would like to see, I want to see Kamala get respect.
Absolutely, and I agree with that. Miss Debbie, same question to you.
Well, the significance of her election is timeless for me, and it celebrates and acknowledges the struggles of all of those who came before her and paved the way. Beginning with those women who first walked through those doors in Ghana, got on that ship, had that transatlantic crossing, had to come here captive, persevere. From them to Breonna Taylor, all of us celebrate her. And also, I think that her victory does pay homage to those unsung heroes. And those unsung heroes include Fannie Lou Hamer, who mm-hmm. gets credit, but not nearly enough.
Exactly.
Ella Baker, who was a force to be reckoned with behind the scene, those unsung heroes. The women who, when the movement was going on and there were those meetings and they had to be clandestine about how they were, they met in those women's homes. Those women prepared dinners, sold dinners to be able to give them their money, to be able to travel and do what they needed to do.
Right.
And they are the true culture warriors. They're the ones from, you know, Sojourner trying to get people to leave when they really didn't have a concept of freedom. No. That's why it's important. And for the women who, you look at somebody like Shirley Chisholm, who according to her wonderful biography that inspired me, was unbought and unbossed, period. That's how she was, and that's how she moved around. And that's what gave us the power to know our power, for us to be able to step into our power. And I said earlier, we raised fists with Angela. We stood mm-hmm. with Sonia Sanchez. We hear it with Kamala. I was crying and screaming and hollering at the TV and trying to answer all the texts and everything and just yes. trying to celebrate. And I was really trying to be very mindful and live in that moment. But with those raised fists, we're no longer going to be in the shadows. We do not have to stand in the shadows in terms of society, in terms of men. We have earned our rightful place at the table.
Absolutely. And for anyone who thinks that Kamala Harris is a fluke, go read her 25-30 year biography, and you will see just how long of a journey this was for her as the first woman of color district attorney for San Francisco, the first female and Black female attorney general for the state of California, the first Black female senator representing the state of California, and now the first woman and Black and Asian American woman to be the vice president-elect and soon to be vice president of the United States. So Shirley Chisholm is her hero. And she is our inspiration, just like she is for many Black women. And for myself, who's also a mother and a grandmother, and for all the brown and Black little girls, and for all girls, they have someone that they can look at and mirror. And mm-hmm. what advice would you guys give to little girls, specifically little brown and Black girls now, who can look at the White House and see themselves? What would you say to them as a word of motivation to them, Ms. Beverly?
Well, first of all, I would like to say this. Don't let anybody tell you what you can't accomplish. If you have a dream,
your dreams can become reality. Being a female does not stifle dreams. You know, when I was growing up, we were given a very narrow assessment of where we could aspire to. We could be teachers, we could be a nurse, or we could be a housewife for the most part, or a secretary. Now we have graduated to vice president, and soon it will be president, because our compass that we have set right now for our young, like my granddaughter and my great grandkids, they have a model that they can look at and they can see. They have a visual aid of where they can aspire to be.
I think that's wonderful. And Ms. Deborah, what do you want to add to that?
I agree with that, the sentiments of my best friend's sister. We stand in the gap for them.
Yes.
I would give them, I would tell them to move forward in life with purpose, with mindfulness, with hope, but to stand. You have this but to stand, and stand tall and proud, because there are things inherent in our DNA that no one can take from us. And I celebrate those unborn girls
who will also celebrate
this victory.
That is amazing.
I celebrate my great, 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 great grandchildren.
Absolutely. The legacies that are yet to be born. And I want to pay homage to both of you who have been childhood friends for over, God, what, 60 years? 55 years? Mm-hmm. And you guys are a testament to sisterhood and what it looks like, you know, mm-hmm. and how women can support each other through thick and thin, highs and lows, ebbs and flows, and just still be there to provide that strong, resilient wall of sisterhood that we call Black women in this country and around the world.
Always.
And you guys, both of you ladies, are phenomenal examples for the legacy of Black girls, brown girls that are not born yet, for those that you brought into this world, and for those who have yet to see your greatness. You are a testament, and you are the shoulders on which we stand to propel ourselves forward. And for that, myself and many, many, many of us are grateful for you. Because without you, we would not have Kamala Harris.
And I love you for saying that. I am so, so, so Black auntie proud of you. I am, you know, come on now, you know, I am a fangirl at this point. And I think I'm speaking for Barbara, but we've moved from teacher to student. I know I have. I'm sitting back, I'm learning, I'm watching, and I'm excited about this level of energy. And I'm excited. I'm enthusiastic for the future, because we got this. We just have to own it and step into our own greatness and not be afraid of success. We got it. It's in our DNA.
Absolutely. It's in our DNA and it's in our control.
And you know, Tish,
go ahead.
This is what, you know, as a teacher, one of the things they teach us is that it's called LLL, lifelong learner. You never, ever stop learning. You never put a cap on your learning. And that, even at our age, I learn something new every single day, because I always open up my eyes and my ears to whatever's around me. You know, I constantly introduce myself to people I've never met. And you'd be surprised who you meet along your journey in this life just by talking to people. And that's
go ahead, right. I'm sorry.
And one of the things, and I'm gonna say this and I'm gonna pin a pin in it. My lifelong relationship and friendship and sisterhood and everything with your Aunt Debbie, she is my sister, my best friend in life. But you know what? We have always respected each other's differences. We know we're not exactly alike. I'm not trying to be her. She's not trying to be me. We respect each other's differences. And if we can take that same energy and pass it to where Kamala's getting ready to go. She may not do every single thing that we agree with, but we need to respect the challenges that she has to go forward with and respect her as a woman that has to make hard decisions, because we didn't get this far in life without making some mistakes. And even in politics, we know that that's going to always be something that happens. But I just know she's going to do her best to do the best that she can.
And that's all we can ask of her. And that's all that's all we can do. So I think that's a great note to leave on. And I want to thank you both for taking the time to share your thoughts and your wisdom with us. It has been an honor to have both of you, Ms. Barbara Flakes Jenkins and Ms. Deborah Bunting, from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for being with us today. And thank you all for listening to KGNU Public Affair. I have been your host, Tish Buford. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.